Welcome, everyone. This is the LaRue Show for Saturday, March 28th, 2009. My name is Marcia Mary Baker, and our topic for today is to kick British imperialism out of Africa, to shut down the ICC, the International Court of Justice, an imperial ploy, and to back restoring the nation state system in Africa and around the world. I'm very glad we have to discuss this topic today here in the United States, connected to us by phone from Baltimore, Larry Freeman. Hi, Larry.
How you doing?
And who is our Africa desk person for EIR News Service. And I am very glad we have speaking with us from Berlin in Germany, Portia Terumbo-Street. Hi, Portia.
Hi, Marcia.
Who is a leader of the International Youth Movement, who is active in Germany and Europe and is from Africa. And most recently at an international conference in Rüsselsheim in Germany, spoke especially about Africa at a whole panel at that conference that the Schiller Institute hosted on the role of youth in the coming Renaissance. I mention that because look for her video of that on the LaRouche Political Action Committee website, lpac.com. I'll mention that again. But our topic, to kick the British out of Africa, is especially important to focus on right now in this showdown battle in which we are engaged over the policy to stop the world financial and economic breakdown crisis instead of making it worse and going into a dark age. Now, everyone has seen in the United States the headlines of the gang of bankers that met at the White House yesterday. They've seen the announcements this week of more crazy hyperinflationary bailout schemes from the United States that's cheered on by the chairman of Mr. Obama's economic advisors, a guy called Larry Summers, who's completely no good. And as John Hofel, our economist, says, this is like more crack to junkies, this policy. We need instead a bankruptcy, a reorganization of what's failing on behalf of serving the interests of humanity, not these speculator financiers. So Mr. LaRouche himself, in the last 48 hours, issued a direct statement, a warning to the President of the United States not to go along with this. I refer you again to Mr. LaRouche's Political Action Committee, LPAC, or LaRouchePAC.com, sorry. And the other thing is he's going to give another international webcast 2 weeks from today. That'll be April 11th. It will be 1 p.m. Eastern Savings Time from the United States. April 11th on a Saturday, it'll be a public event based in the Washington area, and live interactive participation internationally will be the order of the day. Now that's Easter weekend, and I can't think of anything better for a body to do than to get other people to participate that and change the disastrous course that the United States is on. And with that, I think then let's look at Africa in particular. And Larry, if you could begin with some brief overview of the kind of battle lines that we're talking about when we use the expression British Empire.
Well, many of your listeners are probably familiar with the news headlines of the last several days and weeks and actually months, where there's been a great deal of publicity by something called the International Criminal Court, issuing first an indictment and now an arrest warrant against General Omar al-Bashir, the president of Sudan, over the allegations that he has ordered a genocide against the people of Darfur, which itself is a very ambiguous term. But I think it's important that people understand that this is not just directed at Sudan, although the intent of the arrest warrant indictment is actually to remove General Bashir from office and create the conditions for a renewal of war between northern and southern Sudan, and which is to will spread to the rest of the Horn of Africa and then south through the Great Lakes. So the people behind this effort will really cause the kinds of chaos and conditions that could lead to millions of Africans being killed. But the larger question is that the ICC, as a court, so-called, is being given the power to intervene against a sovereign state, Sudan, and a sovereign leader, the president of Sudan, General Bashir. If this were this precedent were actually to succeed, then this would be of great danger to every nation in the world. If you can have an international, super international body intervene over the sovereignty of a country, this would eliminate the power and viability of the nation state. Now, you start off the show by saying, let's kick the British out of Africa. Well, this is an actual total British deployment. The International Criminal Court was brought into being on the ideology of the British, in particular the former Labour Prime Minister, Tony Blair, where he and others representing the Fabian policy of the British advocated a policy of supranational bodies having the right to intervene into nations. And this was discussed in the 90s as a post-Westphalian policy, that is, post-nation-state policy. The creation of the court itself came from two British servants, in a sense. One is George Soros, a notorious advocate of drug decriminalization, and himself a collaborator with the Nazis in his youth in Hungary. He funded and publicized and propagandized for the creation of the International Criminal Court, which is a private institution funded by private entities. His collaborator is a fellow by the name of Lord Mark Malik Brown. And Lord Brown works in the Foreign Commonwealth Office of the British Empire for Africa. In fact, he's a Minister of State in the Foreign Wealth Office for Africa, the UN, and Asia. So these two individuals created a fake court, and they're trying to use this court with support from others around the world to carry out a policy of destruction of the nation state. So this is in everybody's interest to make sure it does not happen. And so far, the current president of the United States, Barack Obama, has, for the moment, stayed clear of getting dragged into this. However, there is a danger there, which we should all be concerned about, which is that the ambassador to the UN for the Obama administration is Susan Rice, who, going back into the 1990s, when she was working for the Clinton administration as Assistant Secretary of State for Africa, advocated policies to dismember and attack Sudan then, and has had a vendetta against the Islamic leadership of Sudan for many, many years. Her claim, as others have claimed, is that the president is responsible for genocide in Darfur. There is no truth to this whatsoever. None. There is a bloody war that went on between 03 and 04, and there's been less conflicts over the last several years. But even in the intense phase and in the last 5 years, there has never actually been genocide, a conscious policy by the government of Sudan against any particular people in Darfur. This has been totally manipulated, and Mrs. Rice knows this is untrue, and nevertheless continues to publicize it and propagandize it with others to whip up public opinion. So I think we should have a discussion among us today, and so that people are absolutely clear on what is behind this policy and what is the intent of this policy by the ICC court and the dangers to all of us if they were to be successful.
Right. Portia, you may want to add more either on the direct case of this International Criminal Court British intervention or on other aspects of the general question of the British Empire, what it's up to today and its legacy.
Well, sure, because, I mean, this is something that, as an African, I mean, it whips up really very deep-seated emotions because, I mean, even if you look at the fact that the non-aligned movement, the African Union, the Organization of Islamic Countries, you know, all these are coming together to say this is completely out of line that they are indicting a sitting president. I mean, the ICC is clearly operating on the basis of a neocolonialist ideology and has no basis for existence and should be banned. And this is the general feeling I've had in, reflected in discussions across the board with anyone concerned with this. And this is something that becomes even more clear when you think of the fact that Lord Malik Brown is the coordinator of the upcoming G20 summit. And, you know, it's something where you have to think about, you know, all these, the question of the same people that are responsible for some of these atrocious things going on in Africa, supposed to now say, oh, let's have a solution for the crisis and this sort of thing, which is, for me, when I think of Mr. Obama and the hope that we all have in Africa for the first African-American president of the United States, really viewing his father coming from Kenya, and the fact that there is this relationship that he does have to Africa, to really take a different stance on this issue, because even on the question of Larry Summers, who as far as I know, in 1991 said you know, African countries should be used for the dumping of waste from the developing sector. I mean, I can only support Mr. LaRouche when he says this sort of person should be replaced immediately, because what is really at stake here is the whole question of the sovereignty. I mean, the United States is not part of the ICC because the U.S. did not want to have its own sovereignty undermined by such an organization. And I think it should take that stance also for all the other developing countries as well, because since its inception, it has not indicted anybody from, you know, in the developing sector, but only from Africa and so on. And this is really what African countries are hoping for, that Mr. Obama will do. That he will look at Africa, you know, from the standpoint of what he can really invest in terms of saying, look, we have a policy of development of Africa that we're going to outdo the Chinese in saying we're going to have development of infrastructure, we're going to have development of the living standards, we're going to have a development of the educational system, and really go all out and go against this British ideology, because it's really going to what it's going to alienate you know, the African community and the Asian the Southwest Asian community from this presidency. Not only is Mr. Obama losing support, it seems, because of this new package that he's gotten out with $1 billion, but this is also something where, you know, it should be clear where the U.S. stands. And I think, you know, as far as that is concerned, I think this is the feeling of all concerned.
Right. Now, you mentioned going against the British ideology. Both of you raised this in terms of the specific figures, like George Soros. He may be, you know, in his functions, Mark Malik Brown, but also this apparatus creating this thing in The Hague called the International Criminal Court. And so, but there's other aspects to the ideology, too, if you want to bring out. I know, Portia, you've spoken out on this before. This green environmental craziness. Prince Charles was just traveling in South America on rainforests, and he wants to lock up the Amazon, the Congo, and a lot of Indonesia. But do you want to say something about this again, Portia, this other aspect of the ideology?
Yeah, I mean, I could, you know, go into that because I think I'm not quite sure what the discussion is. I know, you know, in the U.S., but I know here in Europe, I mean, you have really this whole if you're not a right-wing liberal in the European sense, you know, your average, you know, free trader or whatever, you know, who believes in globalization and so on and so forth. You're either left-wing environmentalist, and these are apparently two opposing camps in the political scene here in Europe, but in actual fact, that's not the case at all, because both of these ideologies are actually British in their root, in their origin, the whole Malthusian ideology of Reverend Thomas Malthus, who was a rich English merchant and tutor of the College of the British East India Company. I mean, you have the sense that okay, this is something more than just, you know, saying we want to save trees and we want to, you know, have more green and so on, because actually, in actual fact, following an environmental policy, environmentalist policy, would mean that you would be destroying, you know, not only the greenery and you know, forests and so on and so forth, but in actual fact, you're also killing people. I mean, I'll just take you back, if I may, to this whole question of the G20 summit, because I think this is where people can actually see what it is, because one of the main suggestions for putting this financial crisis together takes out of doesn't even include what has happened in the last 30 to 40 years of actually taking into account of what has actually gone wrong in the last 30 or 40 years, and this has a lot to do with what the IMF has done, because now it's being said that the IMF has to be lender of last resort on a global scale. And Africans know what the IMF has done to each of their countries, not only in Africa but in South America, in Asia, and this whole issue of saying, you know, the IMF now has to come in and save the day is completely ludicrous, because you know, you have right now a complete crisis. Where African countries always think in terms of what conditionalities were imposed on them, partly with the excuse of, you know, saying, okay, look, we have to have the conservation of nature and so on and so forth, with an emphasis on a forced ruralization program that, you know, that leads to a complete collapse of production. You know, you could take any case study of countries that have been affected by this, be it the Democratic Republic of Congo, that was formerly known as Zaire. You had in the crisis in the beginning of the 70s with copper prices falling. You had a huge budget deficit because most African countries have to export commodities, and this was then followed up by them having to borrow large amounts from the IMF, and they were imposed, these loans were imposed using violent austerity conditionalities, so-called stabilization conditionalities that only stabilized the debt repayment to the IMF, and import restrictions were imposed, and so on and so forth, and your own currency was devalued, that you would have a situation where they would say, you know, you have to have a large population, but you have a large land area, you have to go agricultural, you go rural, no technological development, no large scale high tech infrastructure, none of this sort of thing, which I suppose Americans would have an easier time understanding why this is absolutely wrong, because Alexander Hamilton, the first Treasury Secretary of the United States, he was fighting to introduce manufacturing and industry to complement mining and agriculture, whereas the British-minded faction was already going for, you know, a type of forced ruralization program where, you know, if you put two and two together, you basically have a colonialist policy right there. And this led to massive unemployment. You know, you had the resurgence of malaria, of cholera, other epidemics in the population, which has a direct correlation to the collapse of the living standards. You had famine, massive increase in infant mortality. And you also had, because the living standards were collapsing, you also had a collapse of the environmental area. And I could give you dozens of other such similar cases. But, you know, this whole issue of the British neoliberal policies of the IMF being unleashed or imposed now on a global scale spells disaster for the future of civilization. And this is being set into motion. It can't work, really, because nobody has the money to put into the pool of the IMF. You know, most countries are verging on, you know, total bankruptcy. They are bankrupt, and this is just not going to function. So the only thing that I would just say to that, you know, if you're looking at this ideology, you have to go back to where does it come from. And if you think of Malthus, who he has these nasty, disgusting quotes where, you know, he talks about, you know, anyone born in an occupied world does not have the necessary means for his own existence available, either from his family or through work, simply has no right to subsistence, right? And someone like this, being a key instrument of the British East India Company, tells you really that anyone who thinks that, you know, the alternative is greeny kind of left-wing pro-environment policies. I mean, you have to understand that this is all part of the empire, and if anyone is serious about the development of Africa, they really have to want to eliminate that sort of thinking at all.
Right. Let me ask two things, unless Larry wants to jump in here. But Larry, you've been, over the last decades, you traveled to West Africa different times, all this period that Portia just was describing of this IMF enslavement, the indebtedness, the forced austerity, the absolute anti-development interventions. Do you want to say anything more about that?
Well, we know that while some people in Europe and the United States have suddenly become concerned about some of the infrastructure projects that China is involved in with various African nations, the fact of the matter is that there has been no investment in infrastructure by the United States or Europe since the beginning of the 1970s. And the reason for this is very clear. You had in 1974 the completion of the document National Study Security Memorandum 200, which was initiated and authored in large part by Henry Kissinger. And the tenets of this study was that we should not allow Africans to use their resources to develop their economies. And if there's too many Africans, they would actually form population pressure on the government and create instability. And this would not be helpful to the Western powers having a continuous flow of minerals and raw materials from these countries. And therefore, we should find a way to induce, coerce, persuade, or demand that the African nations reduce their population so we can have an uninterrupted flow of the resources. This mentality, which has been really the British mentality for centuries, became the policy of the United States. And therefore, there's been no policy to actually develop Africa in any way, shape, or form. And very most modest, even in the most modest means of a simple irrigation, energy, transportation, much less capital, scientifically intense forms of infrastructure. And so we know that the policy that, that Portia went through is actually being carried out. If you deny intentionally the development of an economy, and at the same time you nurture and foment conflicts between various groups in that country to weaken the central power of that country so there is not actually a sense of a nation, then that country is going to not succeed. And this is what the intention was. And any country who fights against this policy, such as the Sudanese nationalists, such as forces in Zimbabwe, such as forces in South Africa and elsewhere, they come directly up against the British imperialist policy. And for example, if you take the current case, and when I was in Nigeria, which is a potentially very rich country in terms of resources and quality of people and manpower and skill level, the country was dying and is now in worse shape when I first went there because there's no infrastructure in the country. There's less than 2,000 megawatts of continuous electricity supplied for people in the country, and you have 140 million people. You have 110 million people living in poverty and shacks on $1 to $2 a day. And this is deliberate. And just like the situation where people are brainwashed about the genocide in Darfur, they mislocate who's responsible for the genocide. Why has there not been any development in this region of the world? You look at Darfur, which is in western Sudan. You look at the neighboring border of Chad, north Libya, south the Central African Republic. This whole area is desolate. Yet the whole potential for development has been destroyed because there's been not one single drop of water brought to this area. And therefore, you have a policy of actually killing people by not providing them with the necessities of life, which is water to grow food and to make the land productive. This is how the genocide is actually carried out. And therefore, I think we should talk about genocide, but we should actually name the institutions and the people responsible for the genocide. And we should name those institutions and people responsible for the ongoing deliberate, I would say, enforced backwardness that is placed imposed upon African nations for at least in the modern period for the last 30, 40 years, but really for the last two centuries.
Portia, would you take up or follow along from this and maybe say something the way you did at the Rüsselsheim conference to give the scale of throughout Africa of what Larry was saying in terms of Nigeria or the greater Chad Basin, mm-hmm. in terms of the total population of the continent, the over 200 million people who are malnourished? Could you fill that in somewhat?
Yeah, sure. I mean, I'll just touch upon one thing, what Larry was saying about this freak out, you know, about the Chinese in Africa, and now what the Japanese are also doing. I think it's really important because the Chinese come and they're very clear about their intentions. You know, they want raw materials, they need them in exchange for the building of dams, highways, ports, and housing, and they don't call it development aid, right? They call it business, and you know, why not? I mean, you have in Sudan, the Chinese, you know, they help build the biggest development project on the continent in decades, right? And the Ethiopians also, they're building a huge dam over there, and who are the first people, you know, to come, you know, screaming about, you know, the environment and so on and so forth. The British, and I mean, these things have been on the shelf for, I don't know, how long. I mean, at least, I mean, it was known what you could do with the continent last 70, 80 years, and these projects are nothing new, and these are things that you could easily do. The LaRouche movement in the form of the Fusion Energy Foundation actually published a book in 1980 on the industrialization of Africa, and there is a paper there by Ms. LaRouche called The Myth About Equilibrium Economics. And it's interesting because he says there, right at the beginning, he says, indeed, at this moment, we have more sound projects to launch in Africa than the combined forces of the industrialized and developing nations have at the present economic means to launch simultaneously. And that was back in the late 70s. I think now this is only the more true. And the problem, though, with doing this, and the reason, which is why I would really urge the new U.S. administration to look closely at what the Japanese and the Chinese, now the Japanese are also doing it in the form of their, you know, a new green revolution for Africa and so on and so forth with the rice programs, that the new U.S. administration looks closely at this, because it really is what what Africans want, what is needed. But it has to come, you know, in a concerted effort to do that, because as I went through at the conference, you have right now a situation in Africa with a total population of around 922 million people. You have a demographic situation which really is catastrophic. First of all, I mean, even if you just look at the adult population, that is, you know, you would call the working population. It's limited because you have basically 40% of the population being under 15 years of age, and then you know of that 60%. 11%, especially of the more, you know, youthful 15 to 35, 11% of that population is HIV positive. You have other things. You have things that people probably don't know anymore in the industrialized part of the world. Things like goiter that you get because of an iodine deficiency. These sort of things. 20% of the African population has these sort of things. Children who have it actually don't. They don't have. They have problems concentrating. They're slower. They also, you know, malnourishment in general retards growth in the body of young children, and these sort of things. So I mean, you have a situation where. Basically, if you wanted to really rebuild Africa and do all these projects that have been known, you know, for an unbelievably long time, and to restart these projects, it would require a mobilization of basically all the industrial capacity of Eurasia, of the United States, and the rest of the Western world in order to do that. And I can see in this crisis it really being a chance to use this moral imperative, I would say, of the development of Africa, really to get out to build out of this crisis for the developing developing sector as well as for African nations, because here in Germany. We had a campaign in the Frankfurt area, Hessen, where we said that as part of the civil rights movement solidarity of our party here, we said Hessen's future lies in Africa. But as much as that is true for Hessen, for Germany, it's so much the more true for the United States. And I just want to repeat again that for the first African-American president of the United States, it has to be I think for him, an incredible chance to say, "Look, I'm going to give something that hasn't been done before," to also, I would say, his native continent, as I'd like to think. And this would be an amazing opportunity, so that you get, you know, the basic economic infrastructure. If you look at it, over you know, the graphs that show this, you know, the daily per capita consumption of energy when we're talking in terms of what you want to do, because, you know, the food crisis of last year, and that what was still raging now, to stop this malnutrition, to, you know, actually it would not be that difficult. What you would have to do is really invest in transportation, in basic economic infrastructure, water management projects. These are things that are well known, canalization projects, taking, and this is unfortunately the case still, that like in the case of Namibia, very recently you had huge floods of the Zambezi, basically wiping out the Namibian crop in the last week. And this could be solved very easily, and we have this as part of what the LaRouche movement has outlined for the economic development of Africa. A canalization project of basically damming up that water there, using it basically in a much more constructive way. You would basically have, for example, between the Zambezi and the Limpopo, the Zambezi in the north and the Limpopo in the south, you would be able to, when these floods come, which is very, very quick in the rainy season, and then the water's gone after that, but you would be able to catch the water, bring it down to the Limpopo. It goes through Botswana, which is also a totally arid region. And you would basically, with that one project, you would prevent, you know, the kind of catastrophic things that have happened in the past week in Namibia. Namibia is not the only country that has been faced with this. This is going on throughout Africa. You have the same thing with the Congo River. You would be able to channel the water up to the Chad Basin in the north, and you would be able to use this water for irrigation and transform, you know, what is now, ironically enough, the continent that is suffering the most of malnutrition and these sort of unnecessary things into the breadbasket for the whole world. And that would be a way for the developing sector to get out of its economic crisis.
Right. Let me just interpose one thing, going back to the time prior to the International Monetary Fund conditionalities that destroyed Africa by British Empire design that you mentioned from the 70s onward. If you take the vision of Franklin Delano Roosevelt that colonialism would end after the Second World War, these concrete proposals LaRouche mentioned, I remember many of them. One engineer from Detroit Edison, the electric company in the United States that serves Michigan, his name at the time was Walker Sisler. He has since died, but he in the 50s and 60s went to Egypt as well as Iran, as well as elsewhere in Africa, with a tabletop to scale model of a nuclear power plant for because this was what was he presumed going to be done. And this is just one of many, as was described by the Fusion Energy Foundation in 1980, kinds of projects that were all over, where were being discussed all over in the 1950s and 60s. Part of it through the Atoms for Peace program. So it's, as you say, they've been on the shelf for 50 years, 80 years. Larry, do you want to add to anything about this?
Well, you bring up Roosevelt. I mean, Roosevelt actually visited Africa in 1943, and he actually said, well, we can bring water, and I think he was talking about the Qatar Depression, we can bring water in for the Mediterranean, and that the Sahara will bloom for 100 miles. So this is what Roosevelt saw back, now it's over 60 years ago. And of course, this is known. Everybody, this is not something that is foreign, but the policy has been to precisely not allow this to occur, because what happened in the 1960s is you had the British brought in the winds of change and said, well, basically through nationalist movements across the planet, across the continent, the British could not carry out the same kind of policy through troop deployment and top-down dictatorial control. So they had to remove the troops, and they took down their flags. But they didn't remove the control. And that what you had since the 60s onwards, you had two methods of control. One is through the IMF and the control of prices and terms of trade of the commodity, of the finances and the commodity cartels. Two is the deliberate nurturing of conflict between various ethnic difference groups in these countries of different ethnicity, tribal orientation, geographical orientation, religion, etc., were actually manipulated so that there has never has been allowed to develop in Africa a true sense of a nation, of a republic. And that's been denied. And you see today how these conditions are constantly fomented so that the people suffering exhibit their anger and frustration and rage at their conditions by attacking others who have a different background in their country rather than attacking the actual force responsible, which is the policy coming out of the British Commonwealth or the British Empire more accurately. And so what we see in Africa is that potential is enormous. I mean, it's unparalleled anywhere in the world. Fertility of the soil could feed Africa and other continents. So there's not an objective problem. What there is a policy orientation which has deliberately suppressed the potential for this kind of economic development in the country. And if you take the case of Nigeria, Nigeria had all kinds of potentials when it first emerged as the first republic, and the IMF came in 1983 and took over, or 1985, they threw out the leader at that time, General Buhari, and they imposed the structural adjustment program, devalued the currency, stopped all infrastructure projects, bankrupted the farmers because they could no longer afford to buy the equipment with the devalued currency. The people from the countryside moved into Lagos, which is now a gigantic slum, many parts of it. And so development potential was stopped short. You look at Sudan today, the biggest fear that the British have is that Sudan will emerge as a viable, independent economics nation that can sustain itself and assist in helping other African neighbors. This is the fear they have, and because of the potential in Sudan. And therefore, the targeting of the Sudanese president is really the front end of the targeting of every country in Africa and the countries in the rest of the world who would actually challenge this kind of policy, who would challenge the British policy. So I think that we're right now at a very crucial point because the economic system is melting down quickly. There is chaos on the horizon. The economic conditions of all countries in developing and undeveloped sectors are very bad and impinging on everybody's standard of living. And it's going to get worse until we actually bring in an alternate set of policies. As Ms. LaRouche has outlined very clearly from July 25th, 2007 to the present. Now, under those conditions, either we're going to get a rejection of this Malthusian policy as put forth in National Security Memorandum 200 and the British ideology Green Movement, or we're going to go into conditions that the rest of the world is going to begin to look like Africa. And so this is a turning point, a breaking point for us. And therefore, one of the things we have to do is we have to succeed in making sure that this criminal court, which Mr. LaRouche the other day in a meeting called a drug pusher's court, because it was set up by George Soros, a drug pusher, we can't let a drug pusher's court intervene and destroy sovereign nations, because if that takes place, then there's really not going to be much hope for any nation in the world.
One thing, although please, in the remaining minutes, we have about 14 minutes, bring out anything you wish, but Portia referred to the rejection of the ICC and the condemnation of its warrant for arrest and its whole indictment of President Omar Hassan al-Bashir of Sudan. Could you review, either one of you, review some of the resistance that is out there, some of the potential to organize against this that's unfolding right now?
I mean, I just think, and Larry, you can just add to this also, but I just think that most people, like, if you look at the fact that President al-Bashir went to Eritrea, Egypt, and so on and so forth, that it's time to go there. Look, this flies in the face of you know, the whole outcry of you know, the oh my goodness, you know, the Sudanese president, you know, hasn't he been indicted? I mean, they're just basically saying, look, we are not going to stand for this, because in actual fact, it could be the thing that will inspire basically a whole new movement coming out of this and saying, look, we are against this neo-colonialist policy, because at the same time as this is happening, you know, everybody realizes that any third world leader that will come out and say, I'm going to develop my nation, my country, and not go through the IMF, I'm not going to go through any of these international institutions that have basically destroyed and ruined my country. I'm going to do it country to country. I'm going to talk to the Chinese. I'm going to talk to the Russians, the Japanese. We're going to have treaty agreements. You know, I think it's a warning that anyone who wants to develop their country in this way without going through the dictates of globalization, free trade, and, you know, what have you, that you know, we're going to take you to task for this. And I think, you know, people are realizing, especially in the developing sector, that they have to really stand united against this. And so it could actually just backfire totally on this whole operation.
I think Portia's right about this, because I was thinking similarly that this has so little support. If you, first of all, there's only 100, I think, in 208 countries that signed this treaty of this fake court. So that's a very small number compared to almost 200 nations in the world. You have the African Union, 54 nations. You have the Arab League, the Organization of Islamic Conference. You have the Group of 77, which is a much larger group than 77. It's a non-aligned movement. So you have the majority of nations of the world don't support this criminal court. And therefore, the actual move that has been made by this prosecutor Ocampo, who himself is a flunky of George Soros, this could backfire and trigger very strong nationalist elements in the rest of the world. And this effort, which the British have pushed to go over the top to try to arrest a sitting president, could well backfire. And my hope and expectation is that this could lead to a dissolution of the court itself, that the court could be dissolved because it is shown to be so outrageous in its attack on nations throughout the world. So I think that is correct, that under these conditions, that's quite possible. And to the extent that President Obama has not jumped into this British trap, I think is also something very interesting, because as Portia was pointing out, his grandparents were essentially caught up in what were real Nazi-like policies conducted by the British in the 1950s in the Mau Mau, counter-Mau Mau operation they set up in Kenya, which they carried out the torture that was modeled directly on what the Nazis did. And so Africans of that period in Kenya have a pretty good hatred of the British for very justified reasons, and this would be the parents of the current president. Plus, he's a little more open. He listens. He said, well, wait a second now. The African Union, they're against this. The Arab League, they're against this. So he's taken a very cautious approach, which I think is to his credit. But we have to make sure that we go beyond that. And then, in fact, as I said earlier, it's not just an attack on Sudan, though that's the principal opponent right now. This would be an attack on all of us if you can have a court set up by people like Soros and Malik Brown, deciding what you can do in your nation, who you are allowed to elect. And I just have to repeat the claim that this is being done to stop genocide before. This is hypocritical, if not cynical. because the people who have come out and said, well, the reason we've issued this arrest warrant against General Bashir is because of his he's carried out the genocide in Darfur. But if the National Congress Party of Sudan, which is the ruling party of the North, were to remove General Bashir from office and remove him, prevent him from running again for election, we might be able to make this indictment go away. Well, if that's the case, then you're not, then it wasn't really an indictment based on genocide. It's a political tool. And that's what the rest of the world is reacting to. It is a political tool to ensure the nations of the world in this period of economic crisis do not use their capabilities of their countries and their people and develop their countries economically without involvement of these international institutions such as the IMF, the World Bank, and the WTO. And as Portia said, this action itself may spur more countries to take aggressive nationalist action to defend themselves.
And in the normal world, I mean, lawyers, I mean, a court that's supposed to be, you know, having some sort of mandate, getting money from private NGOs and from private persons, I mean, in a normal world, that is called corruption.
Hmm.
You know, I mean, this should just be called what it is, and it should be dissolved, you know.
Right. One thing I'd like to refer people to is there is a new LaRouche Political Action Committee, LPAC TV, item that was just put up in the last 36 hours called A Silent Genocide. You know, you can see that on www.larouchepac.com, LaRouchePac.com. It's called A Silent Genocide. It's right on the front, on the main page. And it's about how these networks that Larry and Portia, you were just discussing, operating internationally, George Soros, there's another guy, Felix Rohatyn, part of this kind of stable of British dirtbags, how they intervened in American popular opinion in recent years, especially on campuses, high schools, to say Khartoum's genocide against its own people in Western Sudan should be the topic on campuses. A bunch of Hollywood stars got in on it, a New York Times columnist, Nicholas Kristol. So this LPAC TV item says, how do you get to have a false charge of genocide become a populist issue in the United States? So make sure and watch that. And the one thing is, to continue on, is there any update, Larry? In other words, this is, as you all have been saying, a fight that could boomerang to really vanquish or at least put back this particular assault on nationhood in the case of Sudan. In the United Nations, is this going anywhere, or is this,
well,
is Susan Rice still trying?
Well, Susan Rice has a very powerful position in the new Obama administration, and she is perceived as a expert in Africa because of her previous experience during the Clinton administration in Africa, which at that point she was also one of the people responsible for convincing President Clinton to bomb a pharmaceutical plant in Omdurman, which allegedly because it was producing weapons of toxic nerve gas. But she's in a powerful position, but there is a delegation that's going to be sent from the African Union, led by former President Thabo Mbeki of South Africa, who you may well remember went to battle against the same British policy in trying to secure a peaceful policy of government transformation in Zimbabwe and the formation of a unity government. And Mbeki had to withstand a great deal of attacks and nevertheless persevered. So now he's been chosen by the African Union to lead a delegation to the United Nations. The African League is also involved in this. And the Egyptians play a very important role, because I would think, from my knowledge, that the Egyptian government, probably the most knowledgeable people about the four of all the African countries, because it's a real-life question for them. The same area borders on their southern border as well, this general desolate region. So the Egyptians are very active right now in also trying to get a deferment. There, that is a potential exist in the UN for the UN Security Council to vote to defer the implementation of this arrest warrant for 1 year. And the United States, previously in the Bush administration, had said they would veto any deferral. But we don't have the Bush administration anymore. We have a human being in office. And therefore, there is a different potential. Nothing has been discussed on this openly yet. But this, there is room for things to be worked out and for negotiations to take place. And as I said, the role of the African Union and the Arab League is a very positive factor. And I think that this is going to catalyze a great discussion in the United Nations over the role of such an agency such as the ICC. What right do they have to carry out these kinds of activities against an elected president? So I think that there is a great deal of positive political potential lying ahead of us if we sufficiently educate the populations in Europe and the United States.
Well, let me throw in here that the LaRouche Political Action Committee is going to print a mass run of a pamphlet called more or less The War Against the British Empire, which is the title of a March 21st webcast by Lyndon LaRouche, in which many of the things that you all have just been discussing for this hour and LaRouche's evaluations, his proposals on the emergency action we must have on the economic breakdown, that this is going to be included in this 40-page mass pamphlet. Now, that takes resources. It's going to be coming off the presses this Monday or Tuesday.
Oh, excellent.
And therefore, anyone listening in any way now or in the near future, to mobilize, to guarantee the kind of thing Portia said we can do, and Larry, it takes everyone enlisting, the money, the volunteerism, but this can be got out everywhere, and it's going to be out this week. It's the March 21st International Webcast, The War Against the British Empire by Lyndon LaRouche. So in the remaining very few minutes, either one of you can speak, but I couldn't help but recall that Portia, you said at the end of your address to the Schiller Institute conference a few weeks ago, "I believe that we can do it, Mr. Obama." You took the high road that not only should we do it, but we could. Do you want to say anything more about the in this vein?
You know, I get in the discussions I've been having here, at least on this whole question, when people see the short films that were produced with, you know, the transcontinental railway, the water management systems, the energy systems, you know, the fact that we could actually develop Africa with nuclear power, you know, the most advanced technological instrument that we have, you know, the most potent way. People look at me and you know, they have a wry smile and they say, "Wow, you know, who's going to pay for all of this? This is a very nice idea," you know. But you know, how are we going to get governments, how are we going to get companies to you know, invest? And, you know, in Africa you don't have, you know, secured property rights, there's no respect for human rights, there's so much corruption and so on and so forth. And, you know, I just tell them, look, it's easy, you know. You just have to get what Franklin Roosevelt called the British 18th century method. You know, out of there, that, you know, these British, they're stealing. And there'll be plenty for everyone to go around. People have, you know, the sense, and this is what African governments as well as you know, the developed sector has to understand, that, you know, it's not about money. It's not about what, you know, how can we mobilize the funds. As we've seen, funds are easily mobilized. But, you know, what are they going to do? Are we going to create a future? And if we just, let's take the next 50 to 100 years and look back at what we've done, I think if we do it this way, as LaRouche has outlined, I think we'll realize it was the only way that we could have done it, which is why we can and which is why we should.
And, of course, to back up Portia's point,
yes,
There's no shortage of money. We just generated $12 trillion in the U.S. in the last several months to bail out some thieves and scoundrels. So the money is not the problem. It's a question of will and vision. And if we have that, then we can make a lot of progress.
Well, thank you both. The hour flew by. And this is March 28th, 2009, The LaRouche Show closing. I thank Portia Turumbois-Streed. I thank Larry Freeman for their leadership in this fight to get the British imperialism shut down worldwide. And I ask everyone to stay tuned April 4th from 3 to 4 Eastern Time for the weekly LaRouche Show. But April 11th, I tune in to our editor-in-chief of the EIR News Service, Lyndon LaRouche, who will be on an international webcast beginning at 1 p.m. Eastern Time, Saturday, April 11, at www.larouchepac.com. So this is Marcia Mary Baker thanking you all very much.
Thank you, Marcia.
Thank you.